webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
So did Steve just hiccup there, or just what? I've never heard that before. What? You clicked on something, and it... did you lose your microphone in there? Oh, you still got it. Okay, all right. You just weren't saying anything, so I just sort of wondered what that was all about.
What would you like me to say?
I don't know. Normally you grab it and say something. It doesn't look like it's in really good shape there, though. It's sort of falling over and, you know, stuff, but you'll
Well, it's in the same shape it's always been, just because you've got a nice brand new tree of
microphones.
Oh,
I've got a whole tree of microphones
in
here.
It looks like a real radio studio.
Except we're not on radio.
Yes, but it looks like a real radio studio. It looks like a real radio studio.
It looks like a real
broadcasting
studio.
Webcasting
studio. Yes, it does. In fact, those who are accessing the not really quite streaming but sort of webcam thing that someday will be streaming but isn't now can see that things have changed here in the studio. I'm feeling really, I don't know, out of balance. It's the microphone's on the wrong side of me now, and so the light.
No, it's on the right side.
Well, it's on my right side. It's on your left side. But it's it's everything's changed. And part of the reason that we've always wanted to do this, we just finally got around to it. Most of the stuff that you now see in front of me has been laying on the floor out of view of the webcam.
About a year.
Yeah, that's about how long it's been there. But now it's mounted in place. One of the reasons was yesterday morning, my daughter Summer and I were interviewed by Gary DeMar on his American Vision program, which I think will air on about 20 radio stations. Those are radio stations where it's radio waves going out. You can drive in your car and hear it, things like that. Anyway, and that'll be this weekend, and we were talking about... her interesting experiences as a college student with a philosophy professor who clearly not only hates Christianity but also suffers from a very, very bad case of Bush derangement syndrome. And he would do really well on that local station, man. I'm going to tell you something. He would be he'd be a hero progressive talk radio station where today they were freaking Rich out by talking about... about how the secret police from Blackwater are taking away all the liberals.
They're running around shooting citizens and everything, man. I'll tell you. You had to tell me about this about, what, 4 weeks ago.
I shouldn't have done that.
You had to take about 10 minutes and listen to this thing, you know?
I shouldn't have done that. Oh, man. You just got to turn it off, man.
Well, what I need to do is balance it out and listen to Art Bell in the middle of the night.
Oh, good. Wonderful. That's great. Well, anyway, good to have y'all with us on The Dividing Line today. Next Tuesday, Summer and I are scheduled to be on Iron Sharpens Iron with Chris Arnzen as well. So if you don't get a chance to hear the American Vision program, which I forgot to check, is probably available online, I would assume.
That would make sense. Is there any chance we can get around for The Dividing Line before ISI?
Oh, I don't know.
I wanted some sound bites from her. I really love to have that sound bite where she's, you know, Gary asks her about, you know, being prepared upbringing about, you know, these kinds of things.
Weren't you prepared for this? And she started off saying, no, I really wasn't prepared for it, I was sort of like, uh-oh, what are you saying? And she goes, no, I really wasn't prepared for it because I'm used to learning from rational men.
Well, she's got a real good timing. So
deadpan.
She's like,
very
deadpan. And she goes, you know, I was raised and learned to, you know, speak with... rational people.
Yeah. He was laughing. He realized that this was not someone he would want to debate, actually. So anyway, I don't know, because I'll have to check on that. You know, her work schedule, class schedule, and stuff like that gets in the way. But that's next week on Iron Sharpens Iron on Tuesday. We're supposed to be doing that. That's going to be a little bit tricky, though, because they can't handle our phone system or our microphones, remember? So we're going to have to do it somehow over the phone, and I'm not really sure
how. Well, we may just have to use the telephone system and throw it in a conference call.
Yeah, something
like that. Have her on one phone, you on the other, and clear at the other end of the building so that there's no, you know, potential feedback.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. That's a shame, too, because we'd sound a whole lot better going through this thing, but... they're 1961 vintage.
No, I think it's more like 1945.
I've been there. It's about 1961. It's older.
Wow.
Now.
They knew what mix minus was in 1961, though. So
I don't know. I'm not sure about that. It's pretty bad. So anyway, that's gonna be next week. 877-753-3341 is the phone number. I have this odd thought that we were in the middle of something last time, but I don't remember what it was. I can't remember exactly what we were supposed to be talking about last time. So we didn't even get the blog article up with the dividing line until this morning. So that's not good. Oh, and by the way, this weekend, in fact, I think it's tonight, the rest of the world plays their clocks. And that means that for...
Now, I will give the Progressive Station kudos on one point, and that is that they had a commercial today where they were talking about how Arizona doesn't play with its clocks.
Yes.
Because the rest of the country is afraid of the dark.
That's good. I don't mind mocking.
Talking about keeping all of their programs live, and they don't play with the clock, so they're going to have to play with their schedule.
Yep.
Because we don't.
Everybody else does.
Arizonans are not afraid of the dark like the rest of the country.
That's right.
So I like that one.
That's true. And this poor fella in Channel. I was trying to explain to him. He's from up in Canada. And he's obviously gotten used to being coddled by the government, have everything taken care of for you, you know. And it just rips the heart out of you, you know. It just, you're not a man that stands on your own two feet. And I was talking about the fact that simply turning the hands on a clock does not change time. And he kept saying, well, we have more time during the day. No, you don't. Yes, we do. No, you don't. That time is either stolen from you, quote unquote, or given back to you by the largesse of the government. But you're forced to do this, and moving the hands on a clock does not make
any difference. Are you saying this is taxation?
It's time taxation.
It's time control.
Yep, that's what it is.
Listen,
so,
of course, I'm having listened to that station all day. I'm very much susceptible to conspiracy.
Any kind of conspiracy theory that comes along. Yeah. Speaking of conspiracy theories, we are dealing on the blog right now with some of the responses provided. By Shabir Ali. Shabir's been busy. He's even though he was had a debate with Tony Costa. In fact, a couple of them. They're calling them dialogues. I'm always worried when we're trying to arrange a debate and the people putting it on go, well, we'd sort of like to avoid the term debate. We'd rather call it a dialogue. And I just know right then and there that even if this goes off, that at when it's over with, we're going to hear about, well, we very thankful that you came, but it just seems that Dr. White is so straightforward. And we were just looking more for, you know, a sharing time where everyone would feel safe in sharing their individual journeys. And that's the last time I'll be on that stage. I can guarantee you that. So that I always get a little bit worried when folks start talking about dialogues. But he's been pretty busy and cranking out a couple articles, I guess three so far. And what I wanted to do, it's not difficult to respond to this stuff. In fact, a lot of it's just going back over what we did in debate. But it does take a while to type all this stuff up. So I'm going to respond to some of it here on the dividing line and some of it on the blog as time allows. I am falling behind on some other preparation that I need to be doing. So we'll just see how that goes. One of the things I did want to address, but that I definitely I'm going to need to address in a blog, because it's easier to examine shall we say, on the blog, because you have to type things out. By the way, if you're wondering where he's been doing all this, you just go to, I believe, in fact, I'm pulling it up here as we speak, unless, of course, Firefox comes up and says, I want to install some sort of an update or something like that. I'm going to go, no, don't do it. Let's do this again here, www.shabirali.com, I think, is, yep, there you go, and you will see under the articles, comments on Dividing Line of October 23rd, part two, and then there's conversing with a caller on the Dividing Line of October 23rd, 2007. I haven't even seen that one yet. We click on it. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's, there's the story of Achan. Yes, that's, wasn't Paul's religion easy on the Gentiles? Did Peter write the second letter of Peter? Oh, good. I need to throw these in here too. Against the hypothesis that Peter and Paul were at odds with each other is the second letter of Peter, which ostensibly is from Peter. Why is the subject of the second letter of Peter against this thesis? This is what drives me nuts about those who take a controversy that is based on a book written 600 years later and read it back into the New Testament. This is, you know, it would be so easy to create all sorts of controversies between, well, there were controversies in the early Islamic period. There's documentation of controversies in the early Islamic period. That's not really much of an issue, but it would be so easy to come up with theories that you, of course, can't document or demonstrate. But if you get enough people talking about them, you can say, well, scholars say, and scholars say this, and scholars say that. So what you want to do is you have the people who, again, in modern scholarship, have decided that the New Testament is a jigsaw puzzle. And we can chop it up into all sorts of little pieces, and we can take whatever pieces we want and fit them together into new puzzles based upon what we want to say was actually going on, and we can get published by doing this. Now, whether we could ever actually make any meaningful argumentation that this is actually what took place doesn't matter, because what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to pick and choose from the New Testament what we do want to accept and what we don't want to accept. So when Paul himself talks about going to Jerusalem and interviewing hystereisai Peter, and when he talks about the right-handed fellowship, we just dismiss all that because that would blow away most of our theories. So we just throw that out, and we just were to say, well, that's later. That's just Paul, and he's deceptive, and we're not going to worry about that. And so we can create all sorts of controversies, and they're conspiracies. You know, we're going to create a conspiracy that this person was against that person and all the rest of this stuff. So here you have this idea about Peter and Paul. And so allegedly, 2 Peter is all about how Peter and Paul aren't opposed to each other. But actually, if you've read it, it doesn't have anything to do with it at all. The reason this comes out is because in passing, it's not the main point of the letter. It's not the climax of the letter. It's in passing, the letter mentions the writings of Paul as scripture. And so Shabir Ali writes here, against the hypothesis that Peter and Paul were at odds with each other in the second letter of Peter, which ostensibly is from Peter. The letter regards Paul as a brother and his writings as scripture. Well, is that somehow shocking? If Paul was an apostle, would not his, is there some theological reason why his writings could not be scripture? Well, no, unless you know, start with the presupposition of Islam and then read this back 600 years into history, and you've got Islamic anachronistic eisegesis, which is what we have over and over in these situations. But Christian scholars, both ancient and modern, generally hold that this is not an authentic letter of Peter. I'd like to know who the ancient quote-unquote scholars are who held this view. This means that someone wrote it using Peter's name in order to lend it greater authority and to show that Paul is acceptable to Peter. First of all, that's not the thesis of the letter, and that's not the argumentation of the letter, so that's just not true. There are lots and lots of scholars today who reject Petrine authorship for 2 Peter. But the question I wanted to ask Shabir during the debate was, why? And it's real simple. They come up with a theory about what they believe the early church was like and what they believe was going on in the early church, and then they fit the New Testament to their theory. Which is exactly what a lot of people do in regards to the life of Muhammad and the Quran and the development of early Islam, and every bit of it Shabir Ali rejects. So again, we have the double standard. The one standard on one side, well, I will accept anything that liberal scholars come up with, any theory they come up with, hey, as long as they do that and then they get other people to believe their theories, then that's fine, then I'll accept that. But when it comes to the Quran, I'm not going to go there. And this is a direct violation of Shabir Ali's own standards, which he announced in his debate with Robert Morey, where he criticized Robert Morey for utilizing the very kinds of sources that he himself rejects, but that he uses in regards to New Testament Christianity. It is that double standard that, for I think the vast majority of people, results in a rejection of Shabir Ali's credibility on this issue, because he just uncritically will accept almost any of these theories as long as it is supportive of some element of Islamic apologetics, but then turns around and uses a completely different standard in evaluating his own materials, his own sacred scriptures. So why is 2 Peter? Well, you see, 2 Peter and Jude are alike, and the theory is these were issues in the later church, and so they must have come along later once Peter's already gone, so this couldn't possibly be his writing. So what's the fundamental theory here? Well, these were issues in later church. How do you know that? Well, because we have this general idea of how things develop and evolve over time, and of course, this is the very same type of thinking that goes into saying, well, John, for example, must be very, very, very late because it has such a highly developed Christology. In fact, there was a period of time before discovery of more New Testament manuscripts blew this out of the water. There's a period of time where there were people who were suggesting that John was written in the second or even into the third century. Why? Because of an evolutionary theory. The view that it has of Jesus is so high, and we know, and here's the key, folks, we know Jesus wasn't like that. We know Jesus was just an illiterate peasant. And so if there's something that has this high view of Jesus, it must have come along a long ways down the road because, well, we know that whatever the Bible says he was, he couldn't have been that. See? And so you start with that, and then you create a theory as to what the early church was like and what the controversies of the early church was like, and then you fit the New Testament in, and hey, if it doesn't fit your mold, you know what you do? You just cut out the parts that don't fit your mold. You just, well, they're a later accretion, or this is clearly the, and then you start, the neat thing is you then start to get to do ancient psychoanalysis, which is lots of fun. I mean, you can write all sorts of doctoral dissertations about ancient psychoanalysis. It doesn't mean anything, but you can really become very popular if you do these things. And so you start reading into people's intentions, and, well, very clearly, and here Shabir Ali does this, well, very clearly this was written to try to make it appear that Paul and Peter were getting along, as if that was somehow the real big controversy of the day, which it wasn't, but if it becomes a controversy later, 600 years later, or 2,000 years later, or whatever else, well, then that becomes the controversy that we want to talk about, see, and that's when we read it back into those contexts. And I'm sorry, but again, when someone says, yeah, but there's a lot of scholars who say that, well, you know what, there's a lot of scholars who accept a lot of things that they're just given. They're just told this is the way it is, and this great scholar believed that, and I'm just not one of those folks that just goes bowing down and go, well, okay, well, if Albert Schweitzer believed it and he was brilliant, then that must mean it's great. And if Karl Barth said it, then, wow, that's just a fantastic thing. It must be true. And I'm sorry, stick in the mud here, but I sort of want to critically analyze these things and ask the question, really, what's at the foundation of this entire approach to the scriptures? And over and over and over again, it's a real simple thing. The Bible can't possibly be what we always thought it was. And this is one of the major problems with the Christian Academy, is that when you buy into the world's view that scholarship is always coming up with something new, to get your doctorate, you've got to add to the knowledge base. Well, that really is a problem when you believe that God has actually made a revelation that is complete in and of itself. And it discourages the restatement and clarification of orthodox belief, and it encourages dissemination of non-Orthodox perspectives. And if you want an example of this, just look at almost every single theological seminary founded over the past 200 years. What always happens? Look at Princeton today. Compare it to how it started. See a difference? Which direction does it go? Does it go toward orthodoxy? Does it go toward an ever deeper commitment to the scriptures? Or does it move away from that because it wants to bow the knee to humanistic scholarship and be accepted by humanistic scholarship rather than accept the scandal of Christian scholarship, which should start with bowing to the foolishness of the cross, to use Paul's own terminology from 1 Corinthians 1 and 2. Well, anyway, when I examine these perspectives and the arguments that are put forward, and I went to Fuller Theological Seminary, so I got to do that firsthand, it keeps coming back to what's the foundation here? Well, we start with the presupposition that whatever it is, it can't be what Christians have always believed it to be. And so Jesus could not have been the Jesus of orthodoxy, and the Bible could not be the Bible of orthodoxy. And so we start with the presupposition, that's wrong, therefore, what will we do with this text? And that's when you start hacking it up, even though you can't find, you know, Shabir talks about the, well, here we've got this gospel, and there were three different redactors and five different stages. Have we found anywhere a manuscript that supports this? No. Have we found any early church writings? No, we haven't. So it's this wonderful theory, and that's why they keep pushing the dates back on the Gospels. Of course, they can only go so far because you smack right up into documentary evidence of how early the New Testament text was, but you push it as far back as you can because you need to have this time for all this massive amount of redaction. And then somehow all the evidence of that redaction has to go poof, has to disappear. None of it can hang around, stick around. So I'll go, poof, God disappear. Because our theories demand that it was there, but we can't find any of it, so it just all goes bye-bye. So, anyway, that's what's behind these particular things. And so, when I was asking him, what really is the whole idea behind making 2 Peter and 1 Peter, they can't be Petrine. I know the vast differences between the grammar and the syntax of 1 and 2 Peter. I've translated both of them. They were assignments many years ago in seminary when I not only minored in Greek in college, but then continued that in seminary. Took far more Greek than was offered. I had to keep petitioning to take these classes and so on and so forth. And I know that there is a vast difference between these two. I am not a naive person. And I know that it would be very, very difficult for someone to prove that these two books were written by the same person as far as the person actually writing the book. But this is what I tried to point out. The book says that. That's every time I read these discussions about authorship of books, when you read Paul, for example, he's using an amanuensis, a scribe. And Peter, it says through or by the means of Silvanus, there is a scribe that is being used. And we don't know the mechanism. Did Peter speak in Aramaic? And Silvanus is translating, and therefore that's why in that particular instance it is a very classical form of Greek, whereas the other isn't. I mean, we don't have MP3 players running along to tell us exactly when these things were recorded and who did it and things like that. And what people go on is they fail to recognize the difference between possibilities and probabilities when we talk about ancient histories and ancient texts. That is, people go, well, it's possible that this happened. and it's possible that that happened. Well, on that level, it's possible that the Enterprise is going to come back. And what really happened is the Enterprise went through a time warp and beamed somebody down, or maybe it was Voyager coming back, and Neelix wrote First Peter. And that's why it has its the grammar and syntax that it has. I mean, it's possible. Art Bell would think so. You know, I mean, and people will go, well, if you admit that's possible, then you're just admitting we can't know at all. And people don't recognize the difference between possibilities and probabilities. Not every possibility has any probability at all. And when you're constantly are beginning with the assumption, guilty until proven innocent, that might indicate you've got a bit of a bias going on. And that's not just Muslims that have that bias, but liberal, quote-unquote, Christians. In fact, I love the constant utilization by Islamic scholars, by Islamic apologists, of the term Christian scholars. How do you define a Christian scholar? I mean, that's sort of like Bart Ehrman talking about Christian Gnostics. We might as well talk about Christian Buddhists and Christian Muslims. I mean, everyone's laughing about the woman up in the Pacific Northwest who calls herself a Christian Muslim. Most of us recognize those are contradictory concepts. They can't be put together. Neither can there be such a thing as a Gnostic Christian. Just because Gnostics talked about Jesus does not make them Gnostic Christians. I know it's used in scholarship. I find it ridiculous. It muddies the waters and it does not communicate anything. I find it to be simply ridiculous. I don't care how many people use it. If the phrase itself presupposes a bias that results in the inability of anyone to say this is Christianity and that isn't, then it's not really an overly useful term. Unless, of course, that's exactly what you're trying to do, is promote that kind of bias and prejudice against Christianity. And so there's all sorts of terms and positions represented within what's called Christian scholarship today. But unfortunately, the reality is there are not nearly as many Christian scholars as there are people who call themselves Christians involved in quote-unquote Christian scholarship. I mean, if we can at least agree that repentance from sin and faith in Jesus Christ as having risen from the dead, and that faith in Christ is necessary for the obtaining of eternal life, if that's at least semi-definitional of Christianity, that just cut out about 60% of what's called Christian scholarship today, didn't it? Didn't it? It did. Because the vast majority of these folks go, well, resurrection. In fact, I almost fired up a audio portion today. I was listening while lifting this morning to Dawkins and Alistair McGrath. They had a dialogue / debate. It was just, you know, 5 minutes, 5 minutes back and forth. And they're British, so he's also prim and proper. And they use big words, and they have the proper pausing and stuff like that. But Dawkins, this man hates God. Oh, my goodness. He has no idea how totally bigoted and prejudiced he is against the Christian faith. He can't hear his own language. I mean, one of his responses to Alistair McGrath was nothing but nyeh, 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 except it was done in a British accent with big words. But it really, substance-wise, was nothing more than nyeh, 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 nyeh. That was the level of dialogue at that point on the part of Dawkins. He just can't possibly utilize any kind of semi-unbiased examination. One of the things he did is McGrath, I was unaware of this, but has a background like molecular biology or something like that as an atheist. And that was one of the reasons that he was having this dialogue. And one of the things he did was he just, in a mocking tone, I can't believe that a man of science could possibly believe in something like the virgin birth. And of course, I'm sitting back going, earlier in the dialogue, he had mocked the people who had said, you know what? Dawkins doesn't know much about theology. He clearly misrepresents things all the time. He hasn't done any study in this field. And he mocked them with a story about the emperor's not having clothes and mocking people who think that he should be reading all these books about the emperor's clothes because he doesn't have any clothes and that's what's so foolish and so on and so forth. But he makes such simplistic errors based on his own ignorance, and he is unwilling to do anything to get rid of that ignorance whatsoever. But to hear him saying, oh, I can't believe that anyone who's a man of science could possibly believe these things. And you go, well, wait a minute. Time out. If you believe God exists, and of course he keeps calling miracles capricious violations of natural law. They're not capricious. They're purposeful. They have a purpose to communicate something to man about God. But again, doesn't read those books, doesn't think he needs to, so he doesn't get that point. The mockery that someone could possibly have a supernatural viewpoint. Sadly, that comes into play in the Christian Academy as well. And many today would fall in that category of being totally unwilling within the Academy to affirm as a fundamental foundational belief the resurrection of Jesus Christ and, in fact, a supernaturalistic worldview. That's the scandal of the cross, and that's why so much of the Christian Academy is only Christian in name, not in function. If you are unwilling or unable to confess the very fundamentals of the faith, then that's not the Christian Academy. That's just, I'm sorry, call it what you will, but it is not the Christian Academy. Well, all this takes us back the issue of First and Second Peter and things like that. And I tried to point out, do you know what the reasons are? In a scholarly debate, it shouldn't be, well, my scholars say this and your scholars say that. How about going to the point of asking why they say what they say? Let's get into the actual data itself, the actual material itself. And if their assertions are based upon differences in syntax and grammar, well, let's talk about that. If it's based upon, well, I view the issues being addressed by Peter in this particular book to be a later thing. Well, let's find out why you believe that. What is your evidence that the early church did not have the problems that Peter addresses at the time Peter would have been alive? What's your evidence of that? And that's when things get deathly quiet. Those were questions. I was the guy in the seminary class going, how about this? And it gets really quiet when you ask these kinds of questions. And that's what you're trying to do in a meaningful scholarly debate, is bring these things up. And so, again, I fully understand why Shabir Ali wants to completely dismiss the Petrine material. Why? Because he will at least admit it's first century, and it is not supportive of his thesis. And so for the Muslim mindset, well, if this says it was written by Peter, but it wasn't, we can dismiss it. It's irrelevant. It's a demonstration of another person trying to promote the false idea of the crucifixion. See how it works? Now, again, would Shabir Ali allow that kind of reasoning to be used in regards to Muhammad, the Quran, the memorization of the Quran, the collection of the Quran, the Uthmanic revision, any of that stuff? No, of course not. Why not? Well, there's a fundamental presuppositional problem at that point in his system, and the inconsistency is the refutation of the utilization of those dual standards. And so anyway, I will add this particular one to the list of things to look at. The reason I was bringing that up, I'm sorry, I believe it or not, all of that was really only secondary. I'm looking for the discussion of, here it is. This is in part two of the response to the October 23rd dividing line. Did Jesus really say, do this in remembrance of me? Now listen to this. Did Jesus really say, do this in remembrance of me? These words are attributed, I'm reading now, these words are attributed to Jesus in the Bible, in Luke's Gospel, Luke 22, verses 19b through 20. And if y'all don't mind here just a moment, I'm going to increase the text size in Firefox. Man, he uses small text size. That is not easy to read in any way, shape, or form. So we scroll back down. These words are attributed to Jesus in the Bible in Luke's Gospel 22:19b through 20. Do this in remembrance of me. In this way, we learn Jesus instituted the regular observance of the Eucharist, the use of bread to symbolize the eating of Jesus' flesh, and wine to symbolize drinking of his blood. I pointed out in the debate that these words are missing from some very important early manuscripts, and for this reason, many scholars deem it a later addition. Hence, this cannot be taken as reliable proof that Jesus said these words. If he said that these words are missing from some very important early manuscripts, I never heard him say it. I have not had the time. Rich has not had the time. to go through the debate yet. He's gotten the feed into the computer. What you got to do is you got to take these two cameras. You got to feed them into the computer. Then you've got to put it all together and blah blah blah. And it's a long process. It takes a lot of work. It really does. People don't seem to realize how much work it takes. And so I have not had the opportunity can imagine how long it would take anyways, but I may get around to it if I can find the time to do it, of going back. All I remember, and I was taking notes as quickly as I possibly could, all I remember was his saying, scholars feel this is a later edition. Now, when Shabir says that, he's almost always referring to redaction criticism. He's talking to that which does not have any documented evidence behind it. It is all based on theoretical examinations of theoretical sources, and it's not hard criticism. It is criticism based upon theoretical reconstructions. I took him to be making, again, a redaction criticism statement. If I had heard anything about manuscripts, it would catch my attention because that's my area. If anything's going to catch my attention... if I had heard it's not in earliest manuscripts, you would have seen me reaching for my Greek New Testament like that, which is over to my left, and it would have been flying open to Luke chapter 22, and I would have been checking the critical edition of the Nestlé-Aulin text to see what he was making reference to, and trying to continue listening while making a note as to the textual evidence that is something that I might have 15 seconds to comment on and might have all of 30 seconds before I'm going to get up and comment on these things. So it's one of the things that debates is they're challenging, but very, very enjoyable to do. So I didn't hear that. And so when he says, James seems to have forgotten what the point was. Well, if the point was there's a textual variant, I never heard anything about a textual variant. If he said there was a textual variant, then that was my error. On the DL, he asserts that I reject these words simply because they disagree with Quranic teaching. He then uses the starting point to launch an attack on the Prophet Muhammad. I don't remember what quote-unquote prophet. I have a feeling that what he's referring to there, I'm thinking back now to the commentary, I think I have a feeling what he's referring to there was I pointed out that, again, if he's using redaction criticism, which he has to admit he does very, very often, that on the same level he would have to question the memory of the companions of the prophet and things like that and putting together with monic revision and stuff like that. Notice the language, attack upon the Prophet Muhammad. So notice... if you raise textual or critical issues, Muhammad, that's an attack upon him. But he's not attacking the New Testament. I mean, if he's going to say I'm attacking the New Testament and put that in the same context as attacking Muhammad, okay, fine, that's at least fair. But at least be open, because I'd have never heard him talking about attacking the New Testament.
Wouldn't the logic also flow that if you're going to say that, then by going after the followers of Jesus who wrote the New Testament, they're attacking Jesus? By the same logic.
Well, you would think so. But he says here, but I think it is important that we do not become sidetracked. These problems exist apart from Muhammad and the Quran. Shabir does not want to have to deal with his own inconsistencies. He does not want to. He feels much more comfortable being the atheist agnostic liberal from the University of Toronto discussing the New Testament, not the believing Muslim discussing New Testament. The problem is that's a schizophrenic position to take, because I've listened to him. He's done talks. I don't know if he would do this now, but he's done talks promoting Quran codes where you take all the even surahs and even numbered surahs and the odd numbered surahs, and you count up the number of ayah in each one, and it comes to this number and that number, and you can divide these together, and you do all this. It's just like the Bible code stuff was, except it's for the Quran. Now, that's a completely different world than what he wants to stay in New Testament criticism. He wants to stay, he doesn't want to have to, it's sort of like the atheist who doesn't want to have to defend an atheistic worldview in a debate with a Christian. He only wants the Christian to defend a Christian worldview, and he doesn't want anyone to shine a spotlight on whether his worldview can consistently deal with the issues or not. And this happened at Biola. You know, I said, well, I didn't hear anything about the inspiration of the New Testament here, you know. And I had pointed out in my opening statement, this is a debate between a believing Muslim and a believing Christian. We can't take it outside that context. No one in the audience is going to take it outside that context. And so I have to apply the same standards to my belief that I'm going to apply to him and vice versa. And so to say, no, I don't have to apply the same standards. I can be as inconsistent as I want to, I think, again, as an illustration of what we've really got going on here. If I reject, this is going back to quote here, if I reject the words and the basis that they disagree with Islam, on what basis do many Christian scholars reject them? Again, why do you call them Christian scholars? I'd like to ask Shabir, would you call a scholar a Muslim if he does not believe that Muhammad wrote all of the Quran? In fact, I have a feeling that Shabir is listening. If he's not listening live, he'll be listening to the archive. And so I'd like to ask Shabir Ali, send me an email. Would you identify as a Muslim scholar, a scholar, a man who takes a position that Muhammad did not write the Quran? Now, I'm not saying, well, of course, all Muslims don't believe Muhammad wrote the Quran. That's not the point. That he was the one through whom these revelations were given. Would you call a man a Muslim who does not believe that each one of the words and the surahs and the ayahs of the Quran were given by Allah through Muhammad? That allows for the possibility that there is utilization of other sources, allows the possibility that some of these things came from people other than Muhammad, allows the possibility that a later generation, maybe at the time of Uthman or even beyond that, made changes to the words of the Quran or made additions to the words of the Quran. Would you call that person a Muslim scholar? That's what I want to know. That's just a question. That's what I want to know. Because you see, one of the differences here, one of the major differences between us, is that Christians don't kill liberal scholars. You hear me? Christians don't kill liberal Christian scholars. And so they are free to flourish, especially when God's judgment comes upon a nation, as it is upon Western Christianity and Western culture. And so they're allowed to flourish and publish, and apostasy abounds on every hand. And so, but we don't take matters in our own hands and go kill these people. Shabir Ali has to admit, and any Muslim listening here has to admit, that things are different in Islamic countries. The number of stories that you could pull up on your computer right now using Google or Ask or any of the other search engines about scholars in conservative Islamic countries being driven out, have to resign their positions for daring to question anything about the Quran, being imprisoned for running afoul of a powerful imam who considers their less than fully conservative viewpoints to be the subject of a fatwa. You know this is the case. You know that in many of these nations, there is not granted to the academic community the freedom to even discuss these things. This is a fact. We all know this is a fact. And so while there are liberal Muslims, where do they live? They don't live in Muslim countries. They would not be allowed to practice their entire academic work in those particular countries. So when he says, on what basis do many Christian scholars reject them? I've already told you the reason that liberal scholars reject these things, because they create a theory as to what they believe the early church was like, and they fit the material to the theory. That's how it works. That's how it's done. And then it says, let me back up. We're back to Luke chapter 22, and I need to get to this. I didn't realize it was quarter till. I've been going way too long here. I even had this. I was going to go over that, but you know what? I'm actually going to hold off on Luke 22 because I need to put the textual material up. So between now and Tuesday, Lord willing, I'll get all the textual material on the blog, and then we can discuss on the dividing line. I do want to address these two. So hold off on that. I did want to get to these two, and we'll do Luke 22 next week, and you'll be able to look at the blog and see this stuff. Because I can sit there and say, well, these are the witnesses for that, and it's just going to be right past you if you don't have something you can look at. So we'll do Luke 22 next time. Remind me of that so I don't forget it as we get there. I wanted to get to these two real quick. I've only got 15 minutes to do it, less than 15 minutes. First of all, Luke 13:33 is evidence that Jesus did not die on the cross. Reading from Shabir Ali. I will not belabor the point here, but James asserts this point was only marginally related to the atonement. I would have expected him to comment on the point I was making. I was using this verse as evidence that Jesus did not die on the cross. In fairness, I did explain in my earlier report that James has an explanation, with which he may be satisfied that my point does not hold. Yet I press forward with the point here as being at least a piece of evidence that points to a reality other than that to which the Gospels wish to convey. They assure us that Jesus died on the cross, but this verse has Jesus saying that it is impossible for a prophet to die outside of Jerusalem. And John's Gospel does say that the crucifixion took place outside of Jerusalem. James agrees that Jesus said this in self-reference. This means that Jesus himself is the prophet who cannot die outside of that city. It follows logically that Jesus did not die on the cross. James dismisses this implication with the assumption that Jesus did not mean to speak strictly of Jerusalem, but to allow for Jerusalem and its immediate environs to be included in the mention of Jerusalem. Yet it remains that this is a verse that should be placed on the side of the evidence that supports the view that Jesus did not die on the cross. I say to you, there is no such thing as evidence in the New Testament that Jesus did not die on the cross. And think about what this requires us to believe. Other than, quite honestly, an incredible reading of Luke 13, do you really think that this is what Jesus intends to convey here? Well, of course not, because he doesn't believe Jesus ever said any of this. See, so you start with the idea. You start with guilty until proven innocent. Secondly, you have to look at the New Testament as just a bunch of jigsaw puzzle. But just jigsaw puzzle pieces you can put together in any way that you want to. Because at the very least, is he really insinuating that Luke missed this? That this was a big controversy of the day, that Luke clearly wants to communicate that Jesus died on the cross, but somehow, oops, he included something that was evidence that Jesus didn't die upon the cross. No, of course not. I mean, you've got to assume a certain level of intelligence on the part of these writers, that they would at least be aware of these things. And so if you are going to insist that this was the big conflict, then at least be consistent with it. Of course, you can't actually insist that this was the big conflict, that people were arguing about these things, because they weren't. That wasn't the point. People back then knew something real simple. The Romans don't mess up killing people. The Romans are good executors. Okay? They are good executioners. And no one was going, put on the cross, huh? But, oh, well, then, did he die? That would never happen. All you had to say was crucified, and you've just stated that in 99.9999999% of the time, died. Okay? And if Shabir wants to take the 0.00000001 perspective and try to document it for us, okay, then we're really talking about an amazing assertion being made there. But anyway, that simply wasn't the argument that was going on. And so put that together with the fact that it is rather painfully obvious that this is a parallel to the Matthew 23 section, that this is a pericope of judgment upon the Jewish leaders, and that this is what Jerusalem's referring to here, and that Jesus does go. He is condemned there. Yes, it's outside the city walls, but it is ridiculous to argue that, well, that means it was not Jerusalem, and this doesn't fulfill this, and that's what the writer intended, and I'm sorry, but this has got to be one of the weakest. This is as bad as people trying to say John 14 and 16 prophesy the coming of Muhammad based on the Holy Spirit. But there it is. That's where it comes from. Time passing me by. Let me address this one because I thought it was rather important. Did Jesus die for everyone? James wonders if I was aware of the differences amongst Christians on the question of whether Jesus died for everyone or just for those whom God decided in advance to save. He is surprised that neither I nor anyone else brought this up. I chose not to raise this question, as it may have proved a distraction from the main matter at hand. In arguing that Jesus died for no one, I was by implication arguing that Jesus did not die for God's people. I could, of course, point to various Bible verses to show that various authors seem to have different opinions about this. Some thought that Jesus died for everyone. Others thought that Jesus died only for a pre-selected few. Notice he doesn't give any examples there. I'd be very interested in seeing how he could do that. This difference among the writers of the New Testament, the differences amongst later Christians, highlight a problematic question with regards to the atoning value of Jesus' death. If his blood was sufficient to wash away the sins of everyone, why are only a limited number saved, as in the Calvinist view? I chose, however, not to raise this problem at the time, as there were other larger problems the atonement to deal with. Now, the reason I raise this issue is that so much of Shabir Ali's arguments in the past have assumed a universalistic scope of the atonement and have ignored the entire Reformed emphasis upon the perfection of the union of the elect with Christ. And so if you listen to his debate with Mike Lycona, if you listen to the presentation he made when C.J. Forward was supposed to be coming to Toronto and he was delayed at the airport, and Shabir gives a presentation, you don't have to take my words for this. Not only have I played this for you, I played sections of it on the ship. It's on YouTube. You can go look for it yourself. Did Jesus die for the sins of the world? And you'll find it in, I think, three different parts right there on YouTube. Go look at it yourself and see if a large portion of Shabir's argumentation is not directed toward, if Jesus died for the sins of the world, then that means we should be back in paradise. And that means that women shouldn't have pain in childbirth anymore. And since these things haven't happened, then that means that, that Jesus didn't die for the sins of the world. And so the reason I was raising that was so much of his argumentation, even in our debate, did not take into consideration the Reformed perspective of not only myself, but of many of the people sitting in front of him in the audience. And I can tell you one thing, if I was going into a debate, I would want to know whether the Muslim audience in front of me was Sunni or Shia, for example, because that's going to make an impact on certain particular aspects of a debate that we might be having, especially if it is on a question that divides the Sunni and the Shia. I'm going to want to know which is going to predominate because I want to be able to communicate to them in that context. So in that context, so how many of Shabir's allegedly logical arguments against the atonement actually were not relevant to the Reformed position? I mean, when you talk about sacrifice and ransom and you talk about the intertrinitarian relationships of Father, Son, and Spirit in regards to the work of the cross, and you talk about intercession, high priesthood, isn't it obvious that so much of the argumentation that was being made, like, it makes it look like God cut a deal with the devil? No, not quite. Not if you have God from the beginning having an elect people that he unites to Christ. That sort of doesn't fit with the ransom Satan theory, does it? Well, not really. And so it was relevant to bring these issues up because I can pretty much guarantee you that Shabir has never looked at John Owen. And I understand that the majority of people that he would be encountering wouldn't be presenting that perspective. Fine and dandy, but I don't think it's a valid criticism to respond to me saying, hey, you know what? A lot of your objections really weren't aimed at where I'm coming from. They weren't aimed at my presentation. They weren't aimed at my theology. If the idea is, well, I don't really have to worry about your theology, well, okay, but I think Shabir is going to have to admit. In my presentations, when I debate him, I make my presentation against his particular perspective and his arguments. There have been many times that I have been very much tempted, and I just haven't done it yet because there's really not enough time in these debates, but I've been very much tempted to say, what do you think of Jamal Badawi's argument here when he says X, Y, or Z? I almost brought up the statements of one Muslim in a debate with Sam Shamoon, where this Muslim, in a very, very offensive way, and almost stopped the debate, but in a very, very offensive way, says that the Christian Jesus ran like a mouse in cowardice away from his own death, because from their perspective, and I did bring part of this up because I said, look, if you're going to say that Jesus did not intend to die for the sins of the world, then you have a real hard time explaining Jesus' prayer. And that is something that Shabir brings up is that Father, you know, let this cup pass from me. And if the cup was nothing more than a physical death, then Jesus does not approach death with near as much courage as many people we can name today. And this Muslim just simply took that to the to its logical conclusion that Jesus was a coward. And once you take the New Testament apart like that and don't allow for that very reality, that the reason Jesus says, let this cup be taken from me, let this cup pass from me, is that he is as the sinless Son of God, going to become the sacrifice of the sins of God's people. If you read that out of the New Testament, take the New Testament apart like that, well, yeah, then you don't really have any basis for having a whole lot of respect for Jesus. Because the resultant representation of him is not clearly not what the New Testament writers intended it to be, and it ends up being far less than overly compelling. Of course, I've said many, many times before, the Muslim Jesus is very much less than compelling. I mean, we have on this program sat here during the course of this hour and read every Quranic text that uses the name Jesus. And when you put all of that together, and even when you add in other stuff that use other terms for him, which we might do someday, it's still less than 100 ayah, it's less than 100 verses. And no matter what you do, you cannot put together an attractive Jesus from the Quran. You know why? Because Muhammad didn't know who he was. Muhammad did not have access to the New Testament text. All he had was second, third hand, fourth hand information. And the result is that the Jesus of the Quran, which is all the Muslim really has left to him in the modern period because they attack the Bible so much, is not an attractive person. I've said many times, he's not a person. He's an argument. And that's I borrowed that from a liberal Muslim someplace. And it's true. It absolutely solidified my own thoughts on the subject when I heard this Muslim scholar being quoted said that Jesus of the Quran is not a person. He's an argument. He's an argument for the prophet of Muhammad. But since he just speaks out of the ozone, he just sort of floats around. And the only historical context in which he ever speaks is when he speaks from the cradle, which obviously comes from a non-historical Gnostic-tainted source. The fact is that Jesus is not the Jesus of the New Testament, and that is not a Jesus who's going to attract anyone at all. And that is one of the major problems faces the Islamic person. So there's two, the Jesus died for everyone and Luke 13:33. We'll do the Luke 22. Like I said, I'll blog that one so that you can at least go to it and look at the textual evidence, because the issue is, did Jesus say, do this in remembrance of me? Well, the Luke 22 passage is one of the institution passages, and anything like an institution passage where you have material in Matthew, you have material in Mark, you have material in John, and in this case, you have material in Paul in 1 Corinthians, is going to be when you have the institution passages, later scribes are going to want to try to harmonize these things so they all sound the same. And so I'll throw the information together, put on the blog as to what the external evidences are, what some of the internal discussions are. Would have loved to have had a textual critical discussion, but maybe I can find time. Maybe, Rich, when you're putting stuff together, you can sort of put a mental flag that when you get to the part where that came up, where he made that statement about Luke 22 and the scholars don't believe this was original, I can take a look at it and see if he made reference to the textual situation or if he just simply said scholars believe this to be a later emendation and didn't say why. It's quite possible, especially since I'm trying to write things down so quick, that I didn't hear it. Though in this instance, that would be weird, because it was about textual criticism, and I would have jumped on that in a nanosecond. So we will continue, because, man, we're covering a lot of ground. We're talking about scholarship. We're talking about apologetics, all these things relevant to a wide variety of things. We'll continue on The Dividing Line next Tuesday. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.